afternoon. So last time we talked about extending page tables to have this tree-like multi-level structure. And the reason why we did this is that, well, if we just had them be a big flat array, it turns out that array would be just impossibly big. So we needed some way of not storing an entry for every single possible virtual page number. And the way we ended up doing that is we have this kind of tree we arrange our virtual page numbers sort of mapping to, and we just don't store parts of that tree if there's a whole range of contiguous virtual addresses that are all invalid. So we just have this multi-level lookup where we go to the first level that tells us where to go for the second level and so on. And sometimes we go to the first level or the second level, it says, well, there's no more levels. It's just invalid. And we can stop early and not have anything stored for a whole range of page numbers to indicate that. Not have an entry for each of those, just have an entry sort of at this higher level that says there's nothing here. And to make this lookup nice and fast, the way we decided to do our lookup at each level is we took our virtual page number and we divided up its bits into pieces. So we used the most significant bits to look up in the first level. Then if we found something there, we use that combined with this next most significant bits to look up something in the second level, and so on. And another view we saw of this is that we can kind of think of our page table lookup as a bunch of array lookups, where we do an array lookup that gives us the location of the next array until eventually we get to the actual data for the program, and then we're done. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so briefly, some anonymous feedback. So someone saying, gosh, couldn't we deal with complaints about the quiz being too lengthy by making the questions simpler, like the first two questions last time? So I think they talk about question difficulty. I think complexity is more of the issue, like how long it takes to answer a question versus how much you need to know to do that. The main determiner of question complexity is, can I write a question about something that isn't just regurgitate something from the lecture or the reading? Because those are not great questions in general, and also really not great questions when I'm supposed to answer questions about the lecture or the reading while the quiz is out. And that's the amount of setup I need for that is the main determiner of like why questions we're going to take some time to answer. But yes, I do agree that having questions that are faster to answer would be better. Okay, so that's all on anonymous feedback. So we're gonna talk about running programs. So we talked about setting up memory for programs with this mapping from virtual to physical addresses. We're gonna talk some more about how the page tables are going to, and that virtual to physical mapping is going to support running real programs, and then we're going to get into what are kind of the interfaces an OS can provide us to actually start programs and control programs and do things that like your shell does. When you run a command in the command line, like how do we write programs that do those sorts of tasks? So one thing when we're thinking about dealing with page tables and running multiple programs, is we know we can make like system calls, and those system calls sometimes will switch to another program. And a good question might be, where is the code to do that? And one possible answer might be that when we make a system call, we don't use virtual memory anymore. That the OS doesn't use the page tables when it's running in kernel mode, but that's not actually what happens on most systems. On most systems, we still have that virtual to physical mapping when we have an exception happen and the OS starts running, even though the OS is supposed to be able to do things the program can't. And this means that if we say make a system call that's supposed to switch to another program, say we tell the operating system, hey, I don't have anything to do, please put my program to sleep for 2 minutes and run something else. Well, the code for that is up in part of the memory that is available to the program. And this is going to use some sort of instructions that only work in kernel mode. And that's fine. We know that, you know, the program can't just run the, so the program can't just like do that itself. You know, this is going to be controlled by the OS. But the code is in the program's memory because it has to be there for the exception handler to run in. And that means we have a page table entry that points to it. But one thing that's very important about this code is that the reason why we know it's okay for the OS to do things like change the page table in this code is that the OS code is written to not change it to anything that's bad. So an example of what would be a bad thing to change the page table to? Well, if we were on Portal, for example, we wouldn't want your program to be able to change its page table to access my program stuff. But if the code that changes page tables for normal things is in the program's memory, couldn't the program just change that code to do something, to change it to the wrong value? So we need something to stop that, despite the code being there. So we need something to keep the program from modifying that code. You know, otherwise, this is a way the program can kind of defeat the whole idea we had with this user versus kernel mode, that sure, the program can't call a function and have it run in kernel mode, but it can just change the code that runs when an exception happens normally, you know, to do whatever it wants. Yeah. So that would be very bad. So we need some way of preventing that, but we still want that to be in its memory, that code that would be run. Another thing that comes up is, let's say we're on Portal and, you know, two different users are running, say, Vim, the text editor. And if we look at sort of Vim's memory layout, you know, these two different users, they have, each instance has its own stack. They have their own heap, and, you know, it looks like user XYZ4W is, like, doing a lot more stuff, editing big files, so they have a lot more heap being used. And they have some global variables. And we also have some code that's loaded. And since we're running the same program, this should be the same stuff. And something we'd really like to do is only have one copy of that code on the entire server. You know, we don't want to have to load 10 different copies of the Vim code if 10 different users are running Vim. But there's a problem there. What if there's a bug in Vim or some user's malicious and has their Vim try to modify that code? That would break the other user's copy of Vim. You know, if it like segfaults and goes out of bounds and modifies that code, that would crash all the copies of Vim, not just one. So that's something we want to somehow avoid. And to solve both of these problems, we're going to add something to our page tables to allow the OS to have more control over how programs can use the memory that's assigned to them. So in addition to the OS specifying this address goes to this actual physical real address, the OS is going to be able to specify sort of these permission bits. So kind of like permissions on the file system, they will specify permissions for the program on their virtual pages. So with its page table entry, not only will we have a valid bit and a physical page number, we'll also have some bits saying, like, can this page be accessed in user mode? Can this page be written to? Can this page have code executed from it? And the processor, when it does the translation from virtual to physical, in addition to getting the physical address, it'll also check these bits. And if these bits don't match the kind of access the program is trying to do, the processor will trigger an exception just as if the page was invalid. Yes? So the question is, the exception that's triggered different than the one that's triggered if the valid bit is zero? This depends on the processor. Yes?
Can we consider the valid bit like a read permission bit?
Can I consider the valid bit like a read permission bit? I would not say that because, you know, the valid bit's still checked on writes or, you know, executing code, even though if we had a read permission bit, it probably wouldn't be. Other questions? And so how would we use this sort of these permission bits? So in our first case of having this OSS memory that contains sort of sensitive code here, so we have some code that shouldn't be changed, and also sensitive data, this can be marked as not accessible in user mode. So this can be sort of, you know, marked in the page table as not user mode accessible. And the processor will enforce that when it uses those page table entries, if the program tries to access it when, you know, the OS isn't running in kernel mode, that will just cause an exception. The OS will handle that. It will figure out, oh, the program was trying to modify the OS's stuff. Let's just crash it. And for this case, we can mark that this data that's shared as read-only. And by disabling the write permissions in the page table, if the program has a bug and tries to modify that code, we don't have to worry about that actually modifying anything, because instead it will trigger an exception. The OS can run and say, oh, this program had some sort of bug that made it try to overwrite its code. We're just going to crash it rather than breaking any of the other programs that are using this shared piece of code. Questions about these permission bits? Yeah?
Are these the same permissions that are changeable like by chmod?
Question, are these the same permissions that are changeable by chmod? No. So these are specific to part of physical memory, which doesn't necessarily correspond to any files, and that's what chmod deals with. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Do the write and execute permissions refer to a user in user mode being able to write and execute, or to be like a kernel?
So the question is, do these write and execute permissions also apply in kernel mode? I think on most processors they do, but that probably varies between processors. Generally, if you want to know sort of the corner cases of how these permissions work and which ones are available, you have to look at a processor manual, because there's a bunch of different design choices processors have made for them. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so you wouldn't be able to have like a user bit of 0 and then a write of 1.
The question is, you wouldn't be able to have a user bit of 0 and a write of 1? Okay. So the user is, can you access in user mode? And the write is, can you write to it? These are usually checked separately. So if you're accessing in user mode and it's a write, it will check both the user bit and the write bit. Processors differ about whether in kernel mode do we ignore all of these or just the user one? Because you can make arguments for both. You know, kind of, you can think of kernel mode can do anything, or you can think maybe the kernel wants not to be able to write things. That would be nice. I think probably the not ignoring the write bit is more common, because it's convenient for the kernel to be able to detect bugs by marking things as read-only, even though it could change that setting if it wanted to. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, would the two Vim programs both have the same page table entries with the same contents that say you can't write? Yes. So they'll have a set of, so some subset of their page table entries will have point to the same physical pages, but be marked as not writable. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Question, on this table, why is there no read permission bit? Presumably, whatever processor decided in this page table format decided not to include one. Then this is very common in practice, that they'll just say, if it's valid and none of the other permission bits disallow it, you can read it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
OK, other questions? Yeah.
Is there a reason or this table that all the valid bits also have a user bit, or is that just by coincidence?
Question, is there a reason on this table why all the valid bits also have a user bit? That is not true in this example. So, but for the ones it is true, it is mostly a coincidence, yes. Yeah. Why is there no bit for read? As I said, processors commonly will just decide not to have one and just say, if it's valid and not otherwise forbidden, you can read it. Or they could have a read bit. Probably both choices could make sense. Other questions? OK, so we talked about sort of restricting access to pages by more than just a yes, you can access it, no, you can't, to be sort of more granular, to you can access it sometimes, depending on what you're doing, what mode the processor's in. But another thing we've talked about is that when the access doesn't work, it seems like what happens is the OS runs and crashes the program. But when the OS runs, it doesn't have to crash the program. And there are actually lots and lots of cases in typical operation where we'll have a program that is set up by the OS to deliberately trigger an exception for accessing something that is not permitted in its page tables. And as an example of this, I'm going to talk about a problem with stacks. So if you think of stacks, if you've done recursion, you know that, you know, if we're doing something like the Ackermann function, we can have really, really deep recursion, in which case we want a huge amount of stack space. You know, so if we're thinking of writing an OS to run programs that might do a lot of recursion, we want to give the programs like, you know, megabytes of stack space. But most programs don't need megabytes of stack space. Most programs need, you know, kilobytes worth. So it seems like the OS has this hard choice. It cannot support these programs that do lots of recursion, or it can waste lots of memory. But there's this kind of compromise where we can say, we're going to give the program access to lots of space on its stack, but if it doesn't use it, we're not actually going to allocate that. And so basically what we can do is we can say, you know, the program has stack space and it's going to be divided up into pages because that's just how our page tables work. And probably only some of it will be used. So in this example, we have 4 kilobyte pages and 12 kilobytes are used. And conceptually, the program has a whole bunch of extra pages that it seems like we have to allocate just in case it does enough recursion to go there. But what we can do instead is we can not allocate that extra space until the program actually tries to use it. And if the program never tries to use it, well, we've just saved a bunch of time because we didn't allocate stuff that the program didn't care about. And how can we wait until the program tries to use it to allocate it? Well, we can make it so it's not set up in the page table, and when the program tries to access it, we're going to have an exception. So let's say here that my stack pointer has is at the edge of virtual page 7FFC. So right now we've used a bunch of stack space that is in these 4 virtual pages here, which we have allocated in the page table. And then the program runs instruction labeled A here, which is a push. That push is still going to decrement the stack pointer. So we're going to end up with an address that's going to try to use virtual page number 7FFFB, which is invalid because we haven't allocated that space. And when that happens, that's going to run the OS. And rather than saying, oh, you tried to access something that wasn't in the page table, let's crash it, the OS doesn't need to do that. It can instead say, oh, you know, you tried to access this address. It can look up, well, what do you think is there? And the OS can figure out, well, based on how I ran this program, The program thinks that's part of its stack. I didn't actually set up a stack yet, but that's okay. I'll just do that now, and the program won't notice. So what the OS can do is it can look at, oh, the program's trying to access this address that's part of its stack. I'm going to allocate that address so it works now, and then I will go back from the exception and just keep running the program. And the way the hardware will trigger the exception, when the OS goes back, it will try that instruction again. And this time, it's going to work, because the OS changed the page table, so it should work now. So it has a valid page for that address. Questions about this idea of sort of deliberately allowing a program to trigger an exception? In this case, an exception we call a page fault, and then handling that by fixing the page table and having the program retry that operation. Question here? Yeah. Question, this is a way for the program to add more space on the stack in certain circumstances. It's a way for, I would say it's a way for the OS to do that. As far as the program's concerned, it looks like the program always had that stack space, except that the push instruction ran a little slow. Because from the program's point of view, all you can see is that you tried to do a push and it took a little while, and then the push finished. But why it took a little while is because the processor ran the OS to fix up the stack in the meanwhile. But the program doesn't actually explicitly say, give me more stack space. It just tries to use it, and the OS detects that it was trying to use it and fills it in. Yes?
So once it's on that edge of the stack to where it's constantly needing to allocate more space, isn't that less efficient than just initially allocating all that space?
So the question is, wouldn't it be more efficient if the OS allocated this page table entry in advance than this scheme? So, and the answer is probably overall yes, in the sense that with this scheme, we have to have the OS run one time for every page, versus if the OS allocated all the pages together, the OS would only have to run one time to allocate a bunch of pages. So there are kind of two sort of things we can do about that. So one is that, well, if it's the case that the program usually doesn't actually use that many, the savings from not allocating the extra stuff is probably worth it. The other thing is that in this example, I'm showing the OS filling in one page table entry, but if the OS was concerned about, gosh, that's going to take a while to do it for every single page of stack, it could fill in a bunch at a time and kind of take a compromise on how much time it's spending, sort of filling, you know, handling the figuring out what is the program trying to do. Let's fill in those pages as many times. Does that answer your question? Over there.
I think my mic just went out.
So it did. Upper limit to how much stack space can be allocated by the OS? The OS can decide whatever range of addresses it wants to be stack space. Generally, what the OS will do is the OS will have some sort of picture like this, obviously not stored as a picture, but stored as like a data structure with like ranges, and that's how it will decide how much stack space it's given the program. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So this is an idea of allocating space on demand. So, you know, where we wait for the program to try to use something and then we allocate it. And because our exception handler returns to retry the thing, the program just doesn't really notice. Like there's no code in the program to explicitly allocate that. It just tries to use it. And as it tries to use it, the OS fills in the space. And here I'm showing it being done for stack space, but we can use the same principle for loading the program's data from a file, for example. So something that some OSs do is that if we want to start a program, we just figure out what sort of the layout of the program's memory is like this, and we just start it. And as the program tries to access things, we load that in from files, like its executable file, or we fill it in with zeros if it's something like the stack or the heap. And this has the advantage of letting us start the program faster. This advantage that if we do this too aggressively, obviously the program is going to run a bit slower. Okay. Questions about this sort of generalization of idea? Okay. So this idea of responding to these exceptions, which I'll call page faults for pages not valid, or protection faults for the permission bits, say you can't access that. And not assuming it's an error, but assuming it's something you can fix, is something OSs do in a whole bunch of other ways. And sort of the key thing we need to enable this is that the page table exists for the hardware, but the OS has some separate data structure that tells it what's in the program's memory. So whenever the hardware says, hey, my page table tells me the program can't do this, the OS doesn't say, oh, so the program can't do it. The OS says, let me look up what the program should have in that part of memory and see if what the program was doing was actually OK. And if it was, let me fix the page table so the hardware knows about that. So this can be used for sort of allocating things on demand or loading things as the program needs them. It also is commonly used for, we can save some of the program's memory temporarily to disk to save space and load it back later. This is called swapping. We can use this to implement things like a debugger, checking if a variable is modified. We can mark, we can make it so the place where the variable is not writable according to the hardware, and use that so the OS knows when the program tries to write to it without needing to inspect every single instruction to see if it's writing to that. And a whole bunch of other things. And there's one we'll talk about later called copy on write. That's a specific example of one of these kind of ways we can respond to these hardware exceptions saying the memory's not accessible, but not really have the memory be inaccessible and crash the program. Questions? Yes. Okay. So that's sort of about these extra features in page tables. We have these permission bits, and that we can do things other than crash programs when it's invalid. So next, we're going to talk a bit about process management, and I'm going to talk about the POSIX API for process management. So POSIX is the standard for Unix-like OSs, which includes Linux. And these are kind of our essential operations for doing things with processes. We've seen kill already. We probably know about exit. We're going to talk, and we know about get PID. We're going to talk about fork, exec, and wait, or wait PID. We're going to start with fork. Well, first I'm going to start by looking at this, because there's something weird here, which is that process creation is separate from running a program. So that's something that's a bit weird. So we're first going to talk about something that creates a process, but it's not the way we run a program. So if we're creating a process and we're not running a different program, what are we doing? We're going to create a process that runs the same program that we're running now. This is there's a call called fork, which does this. So you might say, well, how does it figure out what that new process is doing? It just copies the current one. And since it copies it, that means now we have two processes with two separate threads meaning they have two copies of all the registers and the program counter, because we copied all that. And that means that fork gets to return twice. It returns once in the original process, which is called the parent, and another time in this new process, the copy, which is called the child. And the parent and child, after that copying operation, have their own memory and their own stack and their own register values. So they're all running independently. And to let you know which one you process you're in, fork returns the PID of the new process in the parent, in the original, and returns 0 as just a sentinel value, just to let you know you're in the child process, in the child, in the new process. And this is a copy, so everything's duplicated. Memory, registers, what files we have open. We'll talk more about how that works a little later. Yeah, pretty much everything but the PID. PID is obviously not kept the same, or else we couldn't tell them apart. So conceptually, if we think about what our operating system is doing, our operating system has some data structure that tracks the information for a process. This data structure has all our registers for the program. It has our page tables, which points to the program's memory. It has our list of files that the program has open, and probably a bunch of other information, like what signal handles are registered, and lots of things like that. And the fork operation is going to make a copy of all this information, and it's not just going to be a shallow copy, it's going to be a deep copy. So it's going to copy all the memory too. So questions, this idea of what fork conceptually does. Yeah?
So you copy all the page tables and files, everything but the PID,
put it in a different memory. So we copy all the page tables and files, everything but the PID, put it in a different memory, yep. So that's sort of our simplest version of fork. As the slide is kind of hinting, there's a trick we're going to use to make this more efficient, which we'll talk about later. But this is the simplest version of what fork does, and fork is always equivalent to doing this, even if it's implemented in a faster way. So it's as if we copy everything. So as an example here, I have some code here which calls fork. So we call fork here, we get a PID that's returned, and this is going to return twice. So once in the parent process, it's going to return a positive number, which is the new PID that was copied into, and in the child process, it's going to return 0. So I have this if statement after my fork to figure out which case I'm in, and in the case of the parent process, I'm printing out this message where I print out the parent's PID, which I get from getPID, and the child's PID that fork gave me. And in the child process, I print out the child's PID and that were in the child. And after both these programs sort of finish doing that printing, we go to this return 0. So this is main, so they're going to both exit, and that's going to be the end of things. So when these run, an example of what might happen is, well, we're going to run, and first we're going to go to this first print here, where we print the parent PID. And that's going to happen before there are two processes. So there's only one process running. That process is going to print parent PID colon and whatever the PID is. So in my example here, that PID was 100. Then we run a fork. And when we run a fork, now instead of having one process running, we have two. So there's two processes, and I'm kind of showing that they're running at the same time. And the order they run in, well, that depends on when the OS switches to them, or if we have multiple cores, like which core is faster. So the original process, the original thread here, is going to run the parent of print. So in this example, that happened first, and it The new PID was 432, so it printed out 100, parent of 432. And then the child happened, and it printed out 432, its PID and child. And because the parent and child were both kind of running at the same time, it could have been the case that these two lines were swapped. Just depending on which one ran faster. So just like if you like open up two terminals and run you know, two different programs at the same time, you know, the order their output will come in will vary depending on which one ends up being faster. Questions? Here. Yeah.
If you were to run this in a terminal, when would your terminal return? After both finish or just whenever?
So question, if I run this in a terminal, when would my terminal make a new command prompt? It would probably do that after the parent finished. Because that is the program it is waiting for. Because that's the one it started. Other questions? Yes. Question, are we guaranteed to get both output from both processes? Both processes will attempt to write their output. So assuming they're writing the output somewhere where you can see it, you'll see it. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Question, if the parent returns before the child, if the parent finishes before the child process returns, will the child process be cut off in any way? Not inherently. Your shell conceptually could do something. You know, if you're running the parent program in a shell, the shell might do something where it cuts off any child processes. But that would be extra work your shell had to do. Like, the default behavior is just that, like, it's outputting the same place, it's going to go there. So only if some program did extra work to catch, oh, there's this extra program that's running that I didn't expect and tried to get rid of it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. Okay, so this gives us sort of an outline of the sort of overall process. So one thing, so I mentioned in this sort of diagram here that you know, it seems like fork does this big copy, and that looks awfully expensive. And that's because, well, you know, we don't actually do that. So this is how we would implement fork without a trick known as copy on write. So copy on write is going to be a strategy that most OSs use to implement fork that is going to give us the same effect. So as far as we as programmers not writing code in the kernel are concerned, it's as if the OS is copying everything. But the OS is not actually going to copy everything because that's really slow. And the trick we're going to use is that, well, if we think of stuff, you know, we don't actually need to copy everything. So some things are easy. So for example, if my shell, bash, is running fork, then its code is going to be the same in both, and it's not going to be modified. So it's read-only, so we can just not copy that. So that's a nice save there. We just don't copy it. We mark it as read-only. But then we have some stuff that it looks like we can't share that way, like this writable data. This would be like global variables, right? It looks like, well, the two different processes, they have separate global variables. We can't have this be shared. But it turns out we can kind of actually have them be shared by being careful that these are okay to share as long as they're writable but not written to. So as long as we don't modify any global variables, we can share the memory that stores them between the two programs. The only issue is if one of the program changes its variables, we don't want the other program to see that because we're pretending that we made a full copy. So you want to pretend we made a full copy, but actually not copy everything, you know, assuming the program's not going to modify most of the stuff. So we need some way of detecting when the program tries to modify something and intervening at that point. And how do we do that? Well, we tell the processor that that writable data is not writable, it's read-only. We just mark it as read-only in the page table, and that means the processor is going to cause an exception when we try to access, when the program tries to write to it. And rather than handling that exception by crashing the program, we handle it by, at that point, actually doing the copy we pretended we did earlier. So we don't really copy right away, but we pretend we do, and whenever the program tries to test, did you really make a copy? Then we make the copy so the program doesn't notice. Yes? So the question is, this requires the OS to have internal tables that track what actually should be a segfault and what should actually be in memory? Yes. So there's going to be a bunch of data structures the OS has for this that the processor doesn't know about. Other questions? So the way this will work is, let's say I have, you know, my program running with a bunch of memory that's used for things like global variables or the heap. If we call forg, we're going to make a new process with its own page table. And rather than copying all the pages that this page table points to, what we can do is we can mark all of the page tables in both the parent and child as read-only and have them share this memory. Then later on, one of the processes might try to access one of these things that's marked as not writable. So the processor will go to this page table entry and say, oh, this isn't writable. The program is trying to write, hey, OS, what do you want me to do about it? And our OS can look up and say, oh, I set that as not writable because we did a process did fork. So what we should do is we should make a copy of the data in this physical page 200AF. So we'll make a copy at that point, put it in a different physical page, so allocate some space for that copy, point the page table to it, and mark it as writable. And then we can go back, have the processor rerun the instruction that tried to write, and everything will work now because it's writing to a copy, not the original. So questions? This idea, yes? So the question is, what if the first process tried to write to its page, you know, its version of that virtual page? Well, then the OS gets to run, and the OS decides what to do. The OS could figure out, oh, I already copied it, so I can just mark it as writable, would be one option, or it could make a copy or something else. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So kind of pictorially, so what really happens in this efficient implementation is we have our process info, and when we fork, it makes a copy of all the data in that process info and a new page table, but the page tables of both the parent and the child originally point to the same stuff. We don't actually copy yet. And then later on, one of the programs tries to write to that. So in this example, we'll say the parent process tries to write to one of these pages. At that point, we will actually make a copy and point to that copy. Point one of the page tables to the copy. Yeah?
So which process is writing?
So which process is writing? In this example, the parent is writing. So the OS is making a copy and pointing the parent's page table to that copy. And if the child wrote, the OS would probably do something similar for the child's page table. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So just to clarify, if say like the parent like writes to something, the copy is supposed to be specifically for the parent and not for the parent and the child, right?
The question, if the parent writes to something, the copy is specifically for the parent and not for the parent and the child? Yes. The idea is that The OS is pretending that when you call fork, it really copies everything, so there's nothing shared. So to do that, when we actually make a copy, it's unique to one process. Other questions? Okay. So, and eventually later on, it's not shared anymore, but okay. So we had this example of sort of how fork works from a mechanical point of view. Let's go through another example here. So here I have a little program that uses fork. And let's say when we run this, the parent process, the original one, has PID 99, and the child gets PID 100. What are two possible outputs of this program? And assume there's no crashes. So something I didn't get into is like fork can fail, like if we're out of memory. Let's assume that doesn't happen. I'll give you a minute. You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on. Who would like some more time? Okay, can someone give me any one possible output? No volunteers, just a possible output of this program. Yes? Okay, so in child 100, and then done. Okay, so. And how would that happen?
If it returned zero, then the process would print in child.
Okay, so this is after.
If the other process returned the PID, then it would print child 100. And if those happened in the order that I said, then it would be printed in that order, and then done.
Okay, so we wanted to have this happen, then this. So this happened in the child process, this happened in the parent process, and what process would the done be printed in?
I guess it's printed in both, so I guess it'd be done.
Yes, so it actually would be printed in both processes. So that's something people commonly miss here, is that after, even though I have this if statement here, the if statement doesn't say stop running after the if statement. So it's going to keep going. And in this case, that means both the child and parent are going to print out done. So our output would have done twice in that case. So other questions about this answer? Yes.
If you had like another statement, another print statement before fork was called, would that only appear once?
So the question is, I had a print statement before fork was called, would that only appear once? Yes. So if we go back to our diagram here, we had that example here where we had this parent PID, and because there's only one process running that runs that, it only happens once. Other questions about this? Yes.
Is it possible that, in child could get printed and then dog could get printed in the same one, and then on the other side
of the problem? Okay, so you're asking, are there other possible outputs? Or?
Is it possible that the dogs don't get printed right after each other?
Question, is it possible the dogs don't get printed right after each other? Probably. So let's take, do you have a proposed alternate output?
Yeah, sure. So
child 100 done. Okay, so your proposal is here. What to actually write? Yes. So we have in child done. So what's happening is the child is running here and then doing this, and then child 100 done. Which is the parent then executes that and then goes on to do print done. I agree that is another possible output. Because when the child and parent are running at the same time, they can execute at different speeds. So they can happen at different speeds. Is there any other possible outputs? Yeah, so child 100 done in child done. I probably should write this somewhere where it can be read. So we could basically, probably an easier way is we could have the order of the parent and child running could be swapped, because after the fork, they can both run and there's nothing that says one has to happen first. It's just whatever the OS decides to run, or whatever core, whatever processor, if there's two cores, that's running them is faster. And I think there's another possible output, which is swapping these two here. And kind of as an illustration, I have kind of the timelines for two of the possible outputs kind of illustrating what's happening. That if we have a single core, the OS is switching between the parent and child after they both exist, because we have two processes. If we have one core, we share that by dividing the time up between them. And depending exactly how that time is divided up, we get different outputs. So do we let the parent run so long enough to print out child 100, or do we let the child run first? That determines which of those happens first. And we can have various interleavings. Yes?
Which one is more likely to happen?
Question, which one's more likely to happen? It probably depends on the OS. I would guess usually the parent process will continue running after the fork because it was already running. But definitely an OS could decide to make fork sort of prioritize the new process if it wanted. Other questions? And sort of as a systematic way of figuring this out, something I like doing is, kind of drawing this diagram where we say, we have a fork here. And then I consider what happens in the original and new process. So I say in the original process, we have the child 100, and we have the done printed. And in the new process, we have the in child, and then the done. And since I see these two things in parallel, I just say, if I have two kind of parallel lines, I need to just decide how do I want to choose things from them going down them in sequence, right? So basically, we can think of these as, so they represent threads, so we can think of like kind of going down this string, these two strings at once, and you know, as we go down each one, we get that output, and we can just choose different speeds. At any point, we can pause on one and keep going on the other. And that gives us all the possible interleavings. So all the possible ways we could run one, then the other. And just think, okay, what if I stop here and go on this one? Or what if I go on this one, and then, so we can enumerate all the possibilities that way. Some questions about this visualization, which I also showed sort of an example of here. Okay, so we talked about fork, and I said that's for creating processes, but this doesn't do the thing that we probably most want to do by creating a process, which is run some other program, right? I can create a new process running my current program, but if I want to like start a web browser or a text editor, can't really do that. So we have some other way of running programs. You might say, why isn't this part of process creation? So on Unix, this is called a bunch of functions that start with exec. So I've represented them as exec star. There's a whole bunch of functions. I'm going to have in my slides one called exec v. There's also exec l, exec ve. They're all just different in how they take their arguments. Otherwise, they do the same thing. They just take their arguments in different ways. And what these functions do is they replace the current program with a new program. So they don't make any new processes, they just change what the current process is doing, whether it's running, change it from running one program to running a different program. So we have the same process ID and actually the same open files. We're just going to be starting a new program in that same process. So as an example, common way you might see this used is that we might use this in combination with fork. So we want to run ls in this example. So I want to run the ls command that prints list of files in a new process. So first, I use fork to create a new process. Then in that new process, I say, I don't want to keep writing the current program anymore. I want to run ls instead. So I call execv to do that. So when I call execv, I need to specify the values for argv and argc for that new program. So here I'm specifying what argv is. So this will become literally argv when ls runs. I also need to tell the operating system where is the program to run. So in this example, on my system, the ls program is located in /bin/ls. That's where the actual executable file that was produced by a compiler is. I need to tell the OS about that. I can't just write ls because it doesn't know which one I'm referring to. There are lots of files named ls somewhere, probably, possibly. I'm telling it which specific one to run. And also specifying my list of arguments to pass as its argv. So this is essentially what your shell does when you type ls minus l. It creates a new process, and in that process, it replaces it to have it stop writing the shell program and start writing the ls program. After I call execv, I have this code here that does some stuff, but as mentioned here, it only runs if execv fails. Because when execv works, we aren't running the current program anymore. We're in the main of the new program, and we're never coming back. So only if execv fails. So for example, let's say bin ls doesn't exist. Like my system administrator removed the ls command. In that case, we go down here because execv would not work and wouldn't be able to replace the current program, and we'd print out an error about that, and then exit so we don't keep going on to whatever's down here. Questions about this scenario? So, looking at our picture here, what we can think of is that we're running a program. We have our program's information here. And what running execv in that program does is it makes this all point to some new stuff. So we just allocate completely new memory for the new program. We reset all the registers. You know, we just replace everything in the process with stuff for the new program we're running. And we also need to copy those arguments. So part of setting up this new memory will be copying the arguments usually to the stack of the new memory. And since we're loading sort of this new program into that memory and discarding the old memory here, so we're going to get rid of that, we can't go back to the original program. In that process, and that process when it runs execv, we can't go back. We've gotten rid of the old program. It's not there anymore. And that's why you see in this pattern, I first use fork, so I'm still running. I'm running two processes, one of which I'm going to replace with ls, the other of which is going to keep running the old program. Questions about what exec does with the program's memory. Yeah?
So if you have the original thing from the fork, that it will no longer share that green memory, right? Unless the other process doesn't care about that.
So the question is, if I had the, in the scenario here where I forked before doing this, that green memory was shared with the original parent process, that's no longer shared after exec runs. Yes. Probably it's still marked as read-only because the OS might not have figured out yet that it's no longer shared because it didn't check yet, but yes, it's no longer shared. And that makes this process seem very wasteful. So we're doing all this work to make it look like we copy the whole program, and most of the time, programs are running code like this, which immediately throws away that whole copy we're spending a lot of time either making or simulating making by changing all the page table entries. So you might say, gosh, why are we having these two functions of starting a new process and running a different program? Why are they separated into two separate functions? Why not just have one function that does both of those things at the same time? Because usually that's what you want to do. And this is a reasonable idea. Windows does it. Create process is a function that both creates a new process and starts running a particular program in it rather than copying the current one. And Unix has added a function that does this called POSIX spawn. The main sort of disadvantage of this alternate approach is that it's a little harder to specify, you know, if you want to run the new program with some particular different state. So for example, with the fork and exec approach, if I want to run ls in a different directory, what I do is I just add some code here that changes to that directory. And I didn't need to have execv take an additional argument to say, what directory do you want to run this program in? But with this, the approach of having a sort of a big create a program, a new process running a different program, if I wanted to be able to specify a new directory that was different than the directory my original program is in, I need to add an extra argument for that. And all sorts of variations of those sort of ways I want to run the program slightly differently. So that's kind of probably why the people designing Unix chose the fork and exec option, is that it made it so they didn't need to have sort of extra functionality to specify exactly how the new program gets run. because you can do that work before you call exec. The disadvantage is that you need to implement fork, and fork is a really complicated function. We have to copy everything, or we have to do lots of complicated work to pretend to copy everything. So there's this alternate API called POSIX spawn, which is basically a function that does both at the same time. This is sort of an example of what calls look like for it. It's supported on Linux, kind of. It's generally a lot less often supported than fork and exec. Like, it's specified by the standard that many Unix system people follow, but it's an optional feature, and many Unix OSs that otherwise implement all the things POSIX specifies for Unix systems don't implement POSIX spawn or don't implement it well. And you could reasonably say that this fork exec idea was a mistake. In fact, some people have said that. So this is a paper from the 2019 conference on Hot Topics and Operating Systems, a workshop known for people having basically operating systems research hot takes, saying that in this paper, we argue that fork was a clever hack for the machines and programs of the 1970s that has long outlived its usefulness and is now a liability. We catalog the ways in which fork is a terrible abstraction for the modern programmer to use, describe how it compromises OS implementations, and propose alternatives. So there's some good reason to think that probably fork is not how things should have worked, but it's what Unix-like systems are mostly stuck with. So it's something we're going to be using in this class for that reason. Okay, so that's on exec. So we talked about creating processes. We talked about running programs in that process, other than the one we started with. Another thing we might want to do, if we think of our shells, we want to wait for programs to finish. So if I run ls minus l, I don't get a command prompt right away. I only get a command prompt after ls lists all the files. And we learned that the way fork works, that if I'm thinking of what's happening here, in this example, this code is running, at the same time as this code, and our parent process could continue going on even after the if statement before the child process finishes, because they're just running independently. So if I have, printf of my, shell prompt here, that might execute before ls finishes if I don't do something about that. So I need some way of waiting for that process to finish doing whatever it's doing. And our main mechanism for doing that is going to be this call called wait PID. There's also some variations of this which all start with wait. I'm going to show wait PID in my examples because I think it's the easiest interface. So this waits for a process to finish. It has to be a process that's a child process, meaning it has to be one you forked from your program. You can't wait for other processes that you did not create. But if you forked a process, you can wait for it by specifying the PID you want to wait for. Some options will mostly use zero, but there's some ways of changing how it waits. And it returns which PID it waited for. Why does it do that? Because you can actually specify a PID of -1 to say, wait for all the child processes I started. And it indicates the status in this status variable. You might say, what's the status mean? So this is where you find out if the program called exit 42, this is where you'll find out about the 42. Or if the program had a signal causes it to terminate, the status will tell you that information. So if a program segfaulted, this is how you'd find out. The status would have a special value indicating segfault. So the general pattern for how this is used is that typically you'll see a program fork. It will do something in the child process, and in the parent process, it will call something like wait PID to wait for that child process to finish whatever it's doing. And commonly, the way this will work is that, you know, we'll call our parent process, it will call fork, the child process will run, it will do something like exec to run a different program, like ls in our prior example. That program will eventually exit, and the wait PID will finish when that happens. And in this way, we can make sure that, for example, we don't print out a prompt too early. Now, we can also end up sometimes, if the program we run is really fast, it might be the case we don't call wait PID until it's already finished. And the way wait PID works, that's not a problem. Until you've waited for it, it's still waiting around for you to wait. So wait PID in that case will return right away, detecting that, oh, the program you started earlier, now it's finished. Let me give you its status. Okay. So I guess that's where I'm out of time. So that's our typical sort of pattern of usage that you'll see, sort of how wait PID and fork and exec are used together. Okay, so next time we'll talk about files and how they interact with starting new programs. Like, how do we deal with files that are already open when we make a new start a new process?